Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio station primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. Joining us today is Carl Kohut, who teaches jazz bass here at the U of M. He earned a master's degree at the Juilliard Conservatory of Music, where he studied with musicians such as Ben Wolf, Ron Carter, and Wynton Marsalis. Kohut is known for his versatility on both electric and upright bass, and has been a sideman on a wide range of musical projects, such as albums by James Dandifer, Earl MacDonald, and Sean Irvine, and performances at notable venues such as Dizzy's, The Blue Note, Smalls, and Jazz at Lincoln Center. Before the interview, I'd like to start off with the quintessential electric bass album, which I'm pretty sure 99% of all bass players listening to this, they already know what album it is. I'm learning about my future house, my future cat, my future tax returns, future ferret, whatever. They all know that it's the self-titled Jacob Astorius album from 1976. It's fantastic. If I could play the whole thing, I definitely would. It's like one of my favorite jazz albums of all time. Definitely in the top 10. This is Come On, Come Over, and Continuum.
You're afraid that you won't like it.
Joining us today is Carl Kohut, who teaches jazz bass here at the U of M. He earned a master's degree at the Juilliard Conservatory of Music, where he studied with musicians such as Ben Wolfe, Ron Carter, and Wynton Marsalis, and also earned a master's and bachelor's degree here at U of M. In addition, he's played with a number of musicians on various projects, such as James Dandifer, Earl MacDonald, Sean Irvine, and Quincy Davis. How are you doing, Carl?
I'm doing good, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. I guess the first question is, what got you into jazz?
Okay. Well, I was really into electric bass, you know, as a junior high and high school student. So kind of checking out some of the great electric bass players, like especially Jaco Pastorius and Victor Wooten were kind of my two idols. But I mean, a lot of other people like Stanley Clarke and Marcus Miller. So yeah, kind of the usual bass players, I think, that anyone who's picked up an electric bass and checked out some musicians, you know, the same people that everyone likes. And because of that, I was applying, or sort of as I was getting into it, I was thinking about applying to the jazz program, and then started to get a little more serious about upright bass. And I was also part of a really good high school jazz band at River East Collegiate. Shout out to, you know, the Kildonans. River East Collegiate with my band teacher, Jeff Kula. And so we were doing this essentially Ellington Festival and like playing the music of Duke Ellington. And so, of course, if I wanted to be in that band, like I had to play upright bass, you know, so all of those things kind of steered me into jazz. And then, of course, when I got to university, you know, I learned a lot more and started to become more serious about it.
Also, who would you say are your influences?
Well, yeah, definitely all of those electric bass players I just mentioned. You know, in the same vein, all the upright players that everyone likes. So Ron Carter, Ray Brown, Paul Chambers, and Christian McBride, I would say, are my four favorites. But branching off from that, I mean, you know, I mean, there's so many people like Dave Holland, John Patitucci, for sure, especially like the way that he is also like an incredible pioneer of the electric bass. Yeah, that's like, I mean, actually too many to think about, but yeah, a little bit of everyone, I would say.
Yeah, you've talked about the differences between upright and electric bass before and how you need to have a versatile skill set in order to use both effectively. So can you elaborate on that a bit more? And are there any things from specific people that you use to kind of craft your bass language?
Yeah, I think, I mean, definitely, you know, the role of the bass player is always kind of the same, whether you're playing upright or electric bass, because you're always kind of the foundation of the music and trying to outline it clearly for everyone. But I think there, in a way, there are certain things that work, you know, certain things that work better on each instrument, and sort of bass players have figured out, you know, what a lot of those things are. So, yeah, like certain licks and phrases, you know, will sound better on upright versus electric, or vice versa, you know, just because of like the physicality of is different. And, you know, of course on upright bass, you can do some fun slides and, you know, scoops into notes, you know, unless you're playing a fretless bass, of course, fretless electric bass. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, that's sort of like the top players on each instrument, you know, have kind of, you know, developed some language that in a way is a little bit specific to each instrument. But somehow there's people like Christian McBride and John Patitucci who can do both. And you know, it's really remarkable. Yeah, something I aspire to.
Yeah, every time I've checked out Christian McBride, his playing and his lines are like super clear. And you can always tell when he outlines a harmony, and like his tone is like really distinctive. But yeah, to go off of that, pianist Kenny Werner, he talks about letting go of one's ego and how that's ultimately the best way to achieve effortless mastery at your instrument. So would you say that bass playing requires musicians to gain a deeper understanding of serving the music through the very nature of being a timekeeper?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's something that I'm always, you know, trying to get or achieve a deeper understanding of exactly what you described. And like a lot of times, or I guess one thing lately I've experienced this phenomenon that you're talking about, just really serving the music, is by playing along with recordings. Because you realize like, you know, there's a lot of recordings that don't even have any bass solos, yet the bass player is an integral part of what the music is doing. So it's like, yeah, you can be just walking a bass line, supporting everyone, yet, you know, on all these great recordings, the bass player is doing something to keep the music interesting and like reacting to different things or shaping things in terms of like the way they construct their lines. So yeah, it's something that, you know, in a way is kind of an underappreciated role. But if you really check out, you know, really check out what bass players are doing in different recordings in their kind of supportive roles, I'll say there's a real art to being supportive, and that's always something I'm like, you know, trying to get better at.
Yeah, because you're not in the forefront, but you're an integral part of the music making process.
Totally. Yeah.
To lead into my next question, there's the meme of when bass solo happens, I fall asleep. What do you think caused that? And is there a way to kind of reframe that perspective in the musical consciousness?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, part of it, maybe part of the problem is that the bass solo is always at the end after, like, you know, maybe it's the piano player that took too long of a solo. You know, I'm just partially joking, but, you know, maybe if it wasn't always at the end, it would be more interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think part of it too is that, like, in a way, I mean, there are some bass players who I would say can like really deliver like really interesting and commanding solos, but in a way we almost haven't been, we don't have the same history of the bass as a solo instrument as like the saxophone, for example, you know. So while we have, you know, Coleman Hawkins or Lester Young, you know, where it's like these recordings from, you know, that era, often the bass was just fighting to be heard for many, many years. And there are also the limitations of recording technology, you know, and until you get a guy like Jimmy Blanton with Duke Ellington stepping to the forefront, you know, there's a number of factors. Also part of it is just like, I think the setup of the instrument. Nowadays, bass players have it easier with steel strings and amplifiers as opposed to like gut strings and really high action. So all that to say is we've been a little behind the curve. But certainly if you listen to someone like Christian McBride, you know, his whenever I've seen him, his solos always get like the most applause. And, you know, I mean, it's a testament to his incredible artistry. So, yeah, so maybe it's just that, you know, not all bass solos are good, but we're working at it. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, a work in progress, one bass solo at a time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Actually, would you say that bass players and like bass solos, would you say that they're more geared towards like rhythmic sensibilities rather than a linear construction? Or would you say that kind of varies from person to person?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some like individual style, like person to person variations. And part of it is that, you know, bass players like are, because we're kind of holding everything together, often when we solo, we still feel the responsibility of kind of holding things together, you know? So maybe we can't just like be free in the same way, you know, like rhythmically free. We always kind of have to make sure, you know, we're making like the form super clear. And I mean, obviously all soloists need to do that. But I feel like, especially as bass players and especially to some degree, like depending on the experience of the other people in the band, you know, so if I'm playing in a situation with some less experienced musicians, chances are I'm just going to like play it pretty straightforward, and not take too many rhythmic or harmonic liberties, just, you know, and this sort of comes back to what we were talking about earlier about like serving the music. The most important thing is that we all stay on the same page. So there's definitely going to be a bit of an adjustment to that. And I think the final thing is that we're just so used to playing the root of every chord that when we solo, it can be hard to to get away from that, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess to pivot to another thing, you earned a master's degree at the Juilliard Conservatory of Music, and you've played with and been taught by Ron Carter, Ben Wolfe, and Wynton Marsalis. So I was wondering what kind of skills or mindsets that you pick up there that you still utilize today?
Yeah, I mean, there's different things from each of those people. But I think I'll start with Ron Carter, because, you know, he's the greatest, one of the greatest of all time, the most recorded bass player in history, like Guinness certified. And he was just, you know, very serious, like, and had such a real commitment to the music and like, you know, would not take any crap. So, a good story is that a fellow bass player friend of mine, had a string on his bass that was unraveling slightly. He was playing gut strings, and then basically Ron Carter kind of cussed him out in front of everyone, being like, you know, is this how you treat your instrument? Basically, so Ron was like, he's like to the student, do you have a gig tonight? And so the student said yes. And he's like, okay, I'm going to come to your gig tonight, and that string had better be changed. You know, and so it's like Ron Carter showing up to some like 18, 19 year old bass player's gig to make sure that he was taking care of his instrument and taking care of the music. So just that kind of like that seriousness and that attitude. And Wynton was the same way. I think the thing with Wynton was that he just knows, he's just so well read and just so knows so much about everything, and was always interested in making connections to other disciplines, like whether it be, you know, visual art or poetry. He was always seeing connections. And if you ever want to understand the mindset of Wynton Marsalis better, you can check out some books by Albert Murray, who is one of Wynton's intellectual mentors. And so, between him, Albert Murray, and Stanley Crouch, they really kind of like shaped the philosophy of Wynton's music, you know, for better or for worse. I know not everyone agrees with it. But I think the thing with Wynton is that even if you don't agree with his philosophy, like he was always able to intellectually back up what he was talking about. And, you know, so I have to respect him for that. And I learned, you know, a ton of other stuff. And Ben Wolf was cool. Ben Wolf taught me a lot. He really knew the music of, like he was really into Thelonious Monk and Oscar Pettiford. Those are kind of his like two heroes, and Paul Chambers, of course. And so just like, yeah, being around someone who knew like all of those people's recordings inside out. You know, I hadn't checked out all that music, certainly not as deeply as he had. And he was funny. He would always, I mean, for anyone who studied with Ben Wolf, he likes to ask you, why did you do that? And sometimes he's not even sure. He just wants you to think about it. And so whenever I do something musically, I always have the Ben Wolf voice in the back of my head. And you know, I appreciated that because he made me sort of just really, really think about everything I was doing. And to this day, I still have that.
Given the positive experiences with all your mentors, would you say that they were a defining factor in your shift into teaching?
Yeah, I mean, you learn a little bit from everyone. I mean, you learn from everyone you encounter as a teacher, you know, a lot of things you want to take from what they did, and some things that you might not want to take. I've always enjoyed teaching, but more so I've always just enjoyed thinking about music, and going through the process of like, how does this work? And because like, really, if you think about it, any great jazz musician, is essentially self-taught at some point. It's like, you know, who taught John Coltrane to be John Coltrane, or who taught Ella to be Ella? You know, I mean, they had things that shaped them, certainly, but to actually figure out their identity as artists, they kind of needed to do that for themselves, you know? And I think just having not been really immersed in a jazz, like, environment until I got to university, you know, I really had to think about like how to make you know, how things in jazz worked and perhaps a more like intellectual way than someone who just like grew up playing jazz music, or, you know, music that comes, you know, in that sort of tradition. And of course, it's like anytime you have to explain something, that makes you understand it better. And so I really now, like, I enjoy what I do. But I also enjoy the fact that I actually learn a lot from myself, like going through the process of having to teach, which is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess for another pivot, the year is 3055. You're a CEO of a large music teaching conglomerate, and you're world famous all around the globe. There's tons of billboards with your face on it. If someone were to say, hey, Carl, you want to expand your franchise, what would be your predominant teaching philosophy that people would like know you by and you could sell to the public?
Wait, what was the year?
3055.
Okay, so I'm having some sort of life extension. Yeah. Okay, so I've had a little over 1,000 years to think about it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, I think, I mean, just like teaching the arts is really important, but I think jazz as kind of like a process, like if you're thinking, you're sort of asking like, you know, what I want everyone to know, like maybe in terms of sort of like a wider audience that maybe hasn't been exposed to jazz. Although apparently I'm so famous that, you know, maybe that won't be the case. But I think jazz is just a really like great tool for like learning anything. Like it kind of music in general, but I would say especially jazz because it's an improvised art form. And so if you can kind of figure out how jazz works and understand, you know, the structures of it and be able to, in a way, speak jazz, you know, fluently in real time, chances are that you can figure out pretty much anything. So, I mean, there are so many lessons to be learned from jazz, but I think just to also kind of understand it as like a creative process is really cool. And yeah, I think jazz has taught me to be more comfortable with myself as someone who's like very shy and introverted growing up. And I mean, still kind of am, but it's a lot easier to kind of come out of your shell when you have something that you're passionate about and then can talk about it, you know? So in a way, like I'm thankful for music for that, you know what I mean? So that's my best attempt at answering the question.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like you'd say that jazz is an extension of you as a person and like it helps you grow like through the music. In 2012, you did a jazz concert featuring arrangements of Radiohead's Kid A. So how did you find that experience? Like what were the challenges involved in arranging it in a jazz context?
Yeah, it was a really cool and interesting experience. And I should say it was part of a concert series that was held at the now defunct, sadly, now defunct Aqua Books. And so the whole premise behind this concert series was, like pop albums reimagined in a jazz context. And so I think Curtis Noasad did one of Bob Marley's music. And I think that may have been one of the first times that Amber Epp did like a jazz thing of Joni Mitchell, which of course then she's kind of like presented multiple times since, which is really cool. And I think I'm pretty sure one of those arrangements is actually on Curtis's first record, you know, so it was actually like it was a really good concept. So yeah, I hadn't done, I mean, I have a little bit more experience as an arranger now, but I think what I mostly try to do is just figure out, like, you know, take the original Radiohead song and then figure out some cool jazz arrangement that I knew and just try to like really mash them together and to make it work. You know, that was basically my concept, was in a way like survival. Like, you know, I had to arrange whatever, like there's maybe like 9 or 10 tunes on the album. I'm sorry, Radiohead fans, like, you know, I know you know exactly the number of tunes on Kid A. I don't know, it's been too long. But yeah, it was really interesting. So like, I'm a believer that you learn by doing. So, and also setting deadlines is really good for yourself. So it's like, okay, after this concert that's coming up, some of the arrangements came more easily than others. But in the end, I figured it out. And so, yeah, so I should also mention that I think I did mostly vocoder for this concert. So I was actually like singing all the things like through a like synthesizer keyboard. For any of you listeners, I mean, I know all your listeners are hip, so they probably know what a vocoder is, but it's kind of this like, yeah, electronic voice. Like if you listen to like Daft Punk or I mean, I guess like now like J. Collier does that kind of thing. Or like the beginning of one of those Bruno Mars songs, like I forget which one it is. You know, anyway. Yeah. All right, I'm done.
The original idea of the meme, as described by Richard Dawkins, is that it's a unit used to convey specific thoughts or concepts within moments in culture. So, do you think that the concept of jazz memes, enhances or dilutes the original work?
I mean, I think anytime, well, shoot, I feel like I need to be careful about what I say. I mean, I'll say personally, I don't have a problem with jazz memes. You know, it's I think, yeah, like in a way, you know, the only constant of the music is that it's always changing. So yeah, I mean, some of them are funny. I mean, definitely a lot of them are funny. I enjoy like humor. I enjoy memes. So yeah, I don't really have a problem. I'm a kid who grew up like my favorite books as a kid were like Calvin and Hobbes comic strips. So, and I had like all the books by the time I was in grade six. So yeah, like a good meme is a good meme. And obviously like if people find it funny, there's probably some truth, you know, there's some truth to it. So yeah. And I mean, there's like, I mean, I think the cool thing about jazz is also that there's such a large span of, like, you know, in jazz music, it can, you can have humor and you can have romance and you can have, you know, like passion and you can have tranquility. You know, it's like all those opposites are possible in jazz. So jazz can also be humorous and it can be serious. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to think of, I mean, if you think about you know, some of the early jazz, I'm trying to think of like I know some historian is going to look up what I say, so I want to be careful. But you know, you think of certain like the slapstick elements of like early jazz with like trombones, like doing the tailgate trombone thing with all the glisses and the stuff, and then you have something like Love Supreme, right? So it's all possible. Like all the entire spectrum of emotion is possible in jazz.
Yeah, there's kind of a balance like with those two extremes, like you said, and you see that represented through like so many eras of jazz. Yeah, I guess, do you have any future projects or any future gigs coming up? Well, not gigs right now, but like
Yeah, I'm actually doing a recording with the Winnipeg Jazz Orchestra this weekend. I'm not sure like when this interview airs, it might be, we might be like on the other side of it. But we're recording some original music, which is always cool. I know there's a commission by Michel Gregoire, who I took some lessons with when I was in high school. And of course she's no longer in Winnipeg, but she's out west, but she's been, you know, has been an important part of the Winnipeg music scene. I forget who the other composers are on it, but you know, it's always cool to do something like that, like with some new music. And yeah, and like, I mean, yeah, with COVID, of course, there are very few gigs these days. Hopefully that'll change. But I'm writing music for an album to be recorded in the fall. I don't want to jinx myself by saying who's on it, but yeah, that's kind of the main thing. You know, I've done a number of things as a sideman, and you know, it's time to do something as a leader. And so it's definitely scary. Like I've been just trying to write as much music as possible with the hope that if I write like 100 tunes, maybe I'll have 10 good ones. You know, that's my, like literally that is my philosophy. Trying to write every day. And yeah, like I said before, you know, you learn by doing. So people always tell you that the first album is the hardest, and I believe them. I'm hoping that this gets easier on the other side, but it'll be good to have that, that project to work towards. And I remember, when I was preparing for auditions, it was now close to 10 years ago, that it was just like a really productive and fruitful time in my practice and my musical development. So, fingers crossed that this is the same thing. So, yeah.
Nice. Looking forward to it. Yeah. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Cool. Thank you. My pleasure.
Do you have any cool albums? Do you have any cool bass albums that'd be cool to play it with? And I said cool twice.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to. Do you have any particular direction, like new, old, electric, upright? I'm trying to think. And sorry, do you mean like albums that I'm on, or just like anything?
Anything, like.
Yeah, I guess to narrow it down, any cool Christian McBride albums you're really into?
Okay, sure. Yeah, that helps. Thanks. Sometimes it's, I needed like a narrowing question. Yeah. I mean, lately, I've been listening to, or sort of rediscovered, Kind of Brown. It's like, I think it's his first record with Inside Straight, but like all the tunes on that album are just so good. Like it's nice because it's a contemporary album, but it's still like swinging and, there's like that blues element to it, which I always, which I like. So that's a good one. We sort of ended up talking about Christian McBride and John Patitucci. Another one, which is actually a really cool one with McBride is like the albums with Chick Corea and Brian Blade. So it's like Trilogy 1 and 2. And they're all good, but the Trilogy 2 in particular, like they do like a recording of Recordame, which is, and there's like a really, really great McBride solo. Of course they're all good. That's another one. That was an album that I was practicing along with just a couple of weeks ago. So it's like fresh in my memory. Another one. I mean, maybe I should just talk about albums I was practicing with. So that Trilogy 2 with Chick Corea, Christian McBride, Brian Blade. And then I was checking out Joshua Redman Wish, which is with Pat Metheny and Billy Higgins and Charlie Hayden. And that's really interesting, like to hear Charlie Hayden in like a really straight ahead context. And like in this album, they play, I think they basically play three blueses and a rhythm changes, and like no one, that's like a 90s thing. Like no one does that, almost in the same way, but like three blueses on one album, but it's great. And of course it's like really cool to hear Charlie Hayden on that. And this is like a bit of a bass nerd thing, but if you listen to the first track is Turnaround, which is like an Ornette Coleman composition. It's a blues in C, and like literally the entire, for all the solos, Charlie Hayden like literally just like stays at like the bottom of the bass. Like he doesn't go past, for the bass players, he doesn't go past like a C on the G string. And then so that was like really interesting. I was like, wow, how does he not like move around at all but still have some interesting bass lines? So, and actually, and the last track on that album is a good one. If you check out the way Charlie Hayden and Pat Metheny, the last song is, I think, actually called Blues for Pat. And then in Charlie Hayden's solo, he kind of actually implies like a bunch of substitute chord changes just based on what he's playing. And Pat Metheny is like right there with him. And so it's like a really cool musical moment. And you get the sense that they're listening really deeply. So that's like an interesting one to check out. And then the last album I was listening to was actually a favorite album of Quincy's, Quincy Davis's, and it's called Buhana's Delight by Art Blakey. So it's like Jaime Merritt on bass. And so like he's the same bass player that was playing on that iconic recording of Monin, you know, is with Art Blakey for a long time. And so he kind of has like an interesting way of like at slower tempos, he plays like a lot of triplets in his bass lines. So you might be like, oh, like Ray Brown. Well, it's not totally like Ray Brown, you know, it's a little bit different. He kind of like fills it up. So that was like really interesting, you know. So with like any album, you know, those were like the three most recent ones I really checked out.
Thanks to Carl Kohut for being here on the show. What you heard before the interview was Come On, Come Over and Continuum from Jacob Astorius' self-titled album from 1976. We'll shift gears into upright bassland to end things off, starting with James Dandifer's track and 2020 album, All the Flowers, where you can hear Carl on bass, and then the track I Never Knew, and then the Chick Corea Trio's version of Recordame off the 2013 album Trilogy, with Brian Blade on drums, Christian McBride on bass, and Chick Corea on piano. This is Canadiana Suite, signing off. Mm-hmm.